This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Hey, Fierce fans. I'm dropping into your feed today to introduce you to a brand new podcast from Tribeca Studios. It's the Tribeca Talks podcast, and you don't want to miss it. These are our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. Live, in person. Remember when that used to happen? This podcast includes one-on-one discussions with directors about their lives and careers. They're intimate conversations with multi-hyphenates in film, TV, and music. Tribeca Talks have always been a staple of the film festival. I've even gotten to host one, and it was some of the most fun I've ever had. They typically take place in April, but right now you can get the same up-close and personal access wherever you are. Now, this first episode celebrates the life of an incredibly fierce woman. Fierce isn't even enough to describe this lady. In it, Barbara Streisand, yes, the one and only Barbara Streisand, sits down with Robert Rodriguez at the 2017 Tribeca Film Festival to discuss how she got her start in the industry, the moment she knew she wanted to direct, the power of will, and so much more. You're going to love this podcast. I can't wait for you to listen. Enjoy.
This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. This conversation between Barbara Streisand and Robert Rodriguez took place as part of our 2017 Storyteller series, where we celebrate multi-hyphenates in film, TV, and music. Paula Weinstein, our chief content officer, introduced the event.
Songwriter, actor, director, producer, recording artist, concert performer, author, philanthropist, humanitarian, feminist, environmentalist, activist, icon. A lot for one person. She's the first female director to ever receive the Kennedy Center honors for more than directing, but she led the way as a director. She received the Presidential Medal of Freedom last year from Barack Obama. She is a tireless fighter for human rights around the world, for health care, for the issues that matter to all of us. And she's here tonight with the extraordinarily talented Robert Rodriguez. Please welcome Barbara Streisand and Robert Rodriguez.
Are y'all coming to my show? Great.
Well, hello, gorgeous.
Oh. Hello, sweetheart.
I know a lot of you are wondering why I'm even up here. So let me just set the stage real quick. Because give me a minute to set the stage because it speaks volumes about the widespread appeal of Barbara Streisand. I grew up in a large Hispanic family of 10 kids in San Antonio, Texas. And in our household, there simply was no bigger star than Barbara Streisand. That's just how it was growing up. She was my mom's favorite. My mom would take us to the Revival Theater to see all her movies when they would be re-released or reissued in her current films. And we were well-versed in film history. She would take us to Revival Theater to see all the movies of like the 30s and 40s and 50s. And we would see who stars were. Still, even with that history knowledge, Barbara towered over all of them. And my mom, who you got to meet, loved to talk to us 10 children about God and about Barbara Streisand. Those are two favorite subjects. And after all these years, I don't remember many Bible stories, but I remember all the Barbara Streisand stories. And so when I first met you, and I've been in the business 25 years, I've been very fortunate to meet some very impressive people. When I first met you, I was so starstruck, and it hit me that, wow, no one, after all these years, no one has ever come close to your level of talent, your level of achievement, your level of accomplishment in so many different areas. And the second thing that hit me was, and no one ever will. Think about that. Think about that for a second. To be an act in the, her acting, her music, you know, she's sold more records than the Rolling Stones. I mean,
are you sure?
And to then to turn into a directing career, I mean, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. If someone did that today, and when you made Yentl, you were the first woman to write, produce, direct, and star in a major motion picture. If somebody did that today, it'd be the second coming. After you did Funny Girl in 1968, she did 12 movies in 12 years, starred in them, while putting out 20 albums, and then turned to directing. I mean...
Oh, gosh.
So when...
Thank you, Robert. Thank you.
So when you have someone that was that impressive of a career, and she's the only one, I think it's just natural that people tend to take them for granted right after some time because they're just so used to them being... But when you go back and study, like I've been doing the past couple of weeks, it's so much material that you find it staggering. And Barbara, we're all here tonight. I flew up from Texas. People came from all over because we do not take you for granted.
Oh. That's very sweet. Thank you, Robert. Thank you.
The stage is now set. So let us begin. First question.
Okay.
How the hell did you do this? Who are you? Where are you? Are you from another planet? I mean, it's unbelievable, the level of talent. What early days sort of define us as artists? What made you want to get into singing in particular? Because you could have been anything. What made you a singer? Because I know you studied drama originally. You wanted to be a dramatic actress. But what broke you? Did you just need to break in any which way? Or how did you do it?
You know, I think it's because I wanted to escape reality. I wasn't happy. I wasn't a happy kid. And I used to go to the movies a lot, Saturday afternoons. I didn't know that they had time schedules, so I would come in any time of the day and sit through two movies. And the only time I ever sat through two movies to see the first one again was to see Marlon Brando. For the first time, it was like, uh-huh. And that inspired me. And I loved the make-believe world, the world of color. You know, I remember leaving the theater and going out into the drab, hot summer days, you know, and thinking, oh, gosh. Inside the theater, it was cool. They had great ice cream. And these movies and movie stars and love, you know, romance. So that's how it began.
And then do you remember your first experience of being on stage? Did you feel like you were at home or did you feel you knew there was... How did you envision? You seem like someone who can vision something and then you just make it happen. What was your vision early on?
Whew, gosh, that's an interesting thing. Interesting question. I remember... I was the kid on the block with a good voice. My MO, you know, my ID was no father, good voice. And we used to harmonize on the stoop in Brooklyn. And, oh! And I thought, my mother arranged, I mean, it's too long to go into this. I've been working for 2 years on my autobiography. I mean, it's endless. So, and it's very hard for me to write about myself. It's like, you know, been there, done that. And now I have to, like, try to remember things. And actually, interesting things come out of it, but mostly it's, I'd rather be directing a film, put it that way. But what was the question?
Oh, just like what was it that first gave you the vision to be a performer? What was the vision that you had for a career? Would you really think you had a chance?
So I had this, I was the kid with the good voice, right? And I remember my mother took me up to audition for Dudley Wilkinson at MGM. Interesting, MGM actually did Yentl. So there's a funny string attached, right? And I sang in a glass booth. And I kind of imitated Joni, what was her name? Joni James, thank you very much. Singing Have You Heard? And I thought, well, just because you get the audition means you're going to be a star. Little did I know, but I lived in a project, and we had a central park sort of, I mean, made out of concrete, but they had swings. And I remember I was double jointed, and I used to do twirls underneath the slide. And I thought, wow, I was 9, I remember then. I thought, I'm going to be a star. And I'm a person who really believes in the power of the will. And I think, I don't know, I think I kind of willed it in a very quiet way, by the way. It's not loud or pushy or anything. It's very internal, very deep. And I do believe that you can manifest your reality. Because when I was 16 in acting classes, I read a book by George Bernard Shaw called The Quintessence of Ibsenism. Because I actually wanted to be in Ibsen plays. And the one sentence I remember out of that book was, thoughts can transcend matter. Thoughts transcend matter. And I thought, okay. You know, even later on when I had a career as a singer, people would say, how do you hold the note so long? And I said, because I want to.
Yeah.
I mean, I never had formal training. I don't know a technical answer to that question, you know? So I think it's because of my will.
When you go up against so much adversity and just barriers, you know, just as a woman in the business trying to, what would you, and you're sensitive. You're a sensitive person and you want to keep that as an artist. Criticism and just push back. How do you get past that? Is it just willpower, or do you tend to ignore the barriers that are put up?
No, I think
if you have strength, but it's not like you're saying you have a very soft strength. You're not made of iron.
No, it's funny because I don't like crappy criticism. I like constructive criticism. I really do. If somebody can show me something that I can do better, I'm all up for it. You know. But what I remember is the bad reviews. I forget the good reviews. I'm working on this book, and I have a researcher, and she tells me these great reviews. I said, what? Where did that come from? I don't remember them at all. I remember the bad. So, you know, that's probably part of an artistic process. You start because, in a way, you don't feel good enough, and yet, there's also the other end of the scale, which is confidence. So it's a funny thing, you know? You have to have both qualities, I think, the self-doubt and the confidence.
I just trying to figure out, and we've talked a lot, and you're still a mystery to me. I can't figure
really?
Out. Yes, because you have such fantastic confidence, yet you still have the self-doubt. But I just wonder, how do you push past the self-doubt? Because you accomplished so much. It spins heads. that what is it that you tell yourself at the point where you get the criticism, especially if it's bad, not constructive, and you just feel like everyone's against you and no one believes you. Like you tell your cameraman, isn't that wrong? And he lies. I mean, when you're just got the deck stacked against you, what takes you over the edge? Is it because you have such a strong vision or just willpower? Or what? You're so in touch with creativity. How do you keep that creativity going?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, maybe certain things are in the DNA. Mm-hmm. I didn't know my father because I was only 15 months old when he died. But in reading his writings, his thesis, and going for a PhD, here I was wanting to be this classical actress, really, and do plays of Shakespeare and Chekhov and Ibsen. And rereading recently his thesis, How to Teach English to Juvenile Delinquents and Prisoners at Elmira Reformatory. It's all about the use of Chekhov, Ibsen, Shakespeare. I mean, I didn't know him. Right. So I think it's in the DNA, you know? And I think my father was somebody who was on the debating team and the French team and wanted to write, but he was interested in psychology and he taught school. So who knows? I mean, there are certain things that are kind of mysterious.
And you're very instinctual, so you tend to just follow your instinct,
yeah,
no matter what.
Yeah, I do. I really go by what feels right to me.
Which would explain a little bit, it's not repeatable, but how you'd be able to have this career. Because if you had done what you were supposed to, listened to people when they told you to do that, played by the rules, you would not have, your career would have been over like that.
But it's you know, that's very interesting because my mother went to work when my father died. So I had no discipline. In other words, I remember teaching my mother how to smoke a cigarette at 10 years old.
Give me a thing like this.
I remember, asking why all the time, or what, questioning things. That's because I also went to yeshiva, and where you learn how to analyze things or question them. And that became Yentl in a sense. I understood her. And I realized, too, when I was writing this book, that my grandfather would take me to synagogue on high holy days, and I would sit with him in the men's section. I wasn't alienated with the women upstairs, right? So I felt kind of familiar with being with the men. Who knows what that has to do with even choosing to do Yentl.
Right. And Funny Girl is one of my favorite movies. Who's seen Funny Girl? It's your first film, starring in a first film. You got an Oscar in your very first film for your performance. It's an amazing film. It's a story of Fanny Bryce, but it easily feels like it could be your story. Because when you sing I Am the Greatest Star, it is like the announcement. You're seeing a star being born on screen in the story, but also in real life. It's uncanny how sometimes people's first films reflect so much of their personality and they kind of become that character. And you soared to greater heights than that character ever did even. What's your favorite memory of working on that movie?
Oh, I loved every minute of working on that movie. And I adored Willie Wyler and my cameraman, Harry Stradling. They were just wonderful. But I remember learning how to dislike the press, because every time I said something or had a suggestion, it was like put in the paper as if we were fighting or something. And I thought, what are you talking about? I mean, I always had thoughts about, I always had opinions. And opinions in the 60s were not popular from women.
Yeah.
It's interesting, they had them in the 40s. Well, that was during the war.
Right.
You know, when men went to war and you were left with the women.
So you had opinions, so much so that director William Wyler gave you a megaphone at the end and a note that said, "Congratulations, Barbara, on directing your first picture." I love that. You're my hero. Because you have to be that person to get through the business being a woman. That's why when you finally turned to directing in Yentl, it's a great honor, but the fact that you were the first woman to write, direct, produce, and star in a major motion picture, it's kind of sad that was the first time. Yeah. But better you than anybody else. Yeah, but only with that kind of willpower, drive, and vision. And you're a Taurus. My mom's a Taurus.
Yes, we're strong, stubborn.
If you want to get run over, just get in her way.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I remember calling Willie before I directed Yentl and saying, you know, I can't wait to talk to you. And he said to me, "I'll just tell you what not to do." And I was fascinated as to what that was going to be. When I came back from a recce in London, I called Willie right away because I really couldn't wait to meet with him. And his wife said he had died.
Oh, that's so sad.
But she wrote me a beautiful note that said, you know, when you're on the set, if you don't know what to do, be very quiet and you might hear Willie whistling. Not whistling. You might hear Willie whispering in your ear. You know, it was just such a lovely thought that I thought, okay. Because I remember Alan Parker saying to me, if you don't know what to do, I tell him to build tracks.
So you can think. Then it takes time. Buys you 20 minutes or 30 minutes.
But you see, being a woman, I couldn't do that. I don't want them to do all this work for nothing. I mean, I couldn't do that. I thought, let's see. But I've already thought about it. You know, I had 5 years to think about it. 14 years before I made Yentl, but 5 years of really, you know, day to day, minute to minute, night to night, writing, searching.
You worked with some amazing directors, William Wyler, Gene Kelly, Vincent Minnelli, and that's just your first three movies. Peter Bogdanovich, Sidney Pollack. Who did you, did any of them encourage you to direct? Or when did you get the idea that you wanted to be a director? Because it wasn't a path women were taking. And that's what, did you always know that it was going to, when did you know that you were going to?
No, I really didn't until, actually, the way we were in terms of film directing, the way we were, I adored Sidney, but, and we were very close friends. We told each other secrets that no one will ever know. But we disagreed on a big thing. And that was that in the way we were, there were two scenes that were cut out that I thought were
essential to the plot.
Pardon me?
Essential to the plot, yeah.
Because now they break up. The two characters, Hubble and Katie, they break up because it looks like he slept with this girl once or something, and that's why they broke up. But they didn't really break up because of that. The two scenes that were cut out were the first one where Katie was driving through the UCLA campus, and she hears and sees a girl sort of like reminding her of herself in the late 30s, when she was standing up in front of this college crowd and people made fun of her. And she got angry. She didn't have too great a sense of humor, whatever. And I pull up the car and I'm pregnant. And I see this girl and I see a crowd gathering and she's talking about the beginnings of the blacklist. And we did this take in one take, because it was so well written, meaning just the idea that Katie drives up to this college and sees a person much younger than herself, but it reminds her of the way we were, the way I was. And I remember loving it in Arthur's treatment. And he did it in one take, one shot, where as I'm watching her, the camera just moves in. And all I did was, I didn't even know what was going to happen, but what happened to me was I started off kind of thinking, my God, is that what I looked like, you know, and sounded like? And then as the camera moved in, I got so sad. So by the end of the move-in, I was sobbing. Okay, now that was cut out of the film. And I thought, because I had wanted Redford to have, I loved the structure. Here's this love scene, me and Redford together. I love you, I love, I want us to be together. And he said, you know, we love each other. That's the trouble we do. Now the next scene was going to be me at UCLA. And then we added a scene for Redford in the boat where he's talking about the best years. And that was perfect structurally because it was like, we love each other. Then you have her alone and you have him alone. And here's the next scene that was cut out. Starts with Redford saying, who's Frankie McVeigh in their beach house? And I said, you know, the kid from the YCL, remember, played by James Woods.
Yeah, the James Woods
character. Right? And he says, he just informed on you. He what? What are you talking about? Yeah, well, you know, I said some sort of line about he must have hated that you cut in at the dance. I don't know. I mean, what could he be using as what is he talking about? There was a scene before I tell Redford I'm pregnant where I said, you know, how I spent my days, I write synopses of these crappy screenplays. One of them today, I made up, you know, a Chinese rice patty or something like that. That's the kind of crap they're using against me. But there's no reason. I mean, people should not be informing on each other. And you know what this means, Hubble? This means that if you have a subversive wife, you get fired. You can't stay in this town. And he says, I'll go back to writing my novel. And now it cuts into what is in the movie now.
Right.
I sit down at the table and I say, it's amazing how events change your life willy-nilly. What events?
Yeah, you don't know what you're talking
about.
What
events? The point is that by the end of that scene, I say to him, will you stay with me till the baby's born?
Yeah, right.
Because I've made that decision. The character of Katie, our politics and our love story come together at that moment. That's the climax of the film. You can see this conversation, by the way, if you ever look at the way we were, DVD?
DVD extras, deleted scenes or something?
This was a conversation that was filmed between Sydney, me, and Arthur Lawrence. And it's very interesting to hear this, you know, because Sydney and I have always disagreed about this. I begged them, you know, throw out 20 minutes of the film. Yes, they were boring political scenes.
Right.
But don't throw out these 5 minutes.
And you told me it was cut for length, and you're like, well, cut one of the other scenes. Why are you cutting that scene?
Well, I mean, no, there were other scenes that were cut that were right to cut. You know what I'm saying? Like, he made a big chunk, 20-minute cut. And 15 of those minutes were right to go out. But Sydney told me when I said, why would you cut that? And he said, nobody would believe that stuff about, you know, Chinese. And this was 3 months before Watergate. And, I, you know, when Watergate came, would you believe the plumbers went in and they screwed up the lock? And then that, you know, who would believe that story?
So when you...
That's when I decided to be a director.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm directing from now on. Well, I mean, by that point, you'd already done so many records. And when you're doing records, you are the director. So was it hard to have so much control and see so much success by having control and the recording? You're a mega multi-hyphenate. So you have complete control in the music world. But then you go and you're being in a movie and you're begging for things that you don't get. That's what made you become a film director in a way, probably.
In a way. I mean, my first film, Willie, you know, he sat with me at dailies.
Showed you dailies that you...
And he, when he put this film together, I must say, 95% of the shots that he picked and the takes, because I was editing in my head, watching the dailies every day.
Right.
And I swear, he put together the film the way I... Except for the story I told you earlier about, and where I wanted to refilm the song live.
Refilm the last song.
The last scene. Yeah, but I don't know. I couldn't believe, because the rest of the movie I thought was great, you know, the way we were. But I couldn't understand those two scenes, you know, being cut. Also, it's interesting. I remember thinking, you know, they break up, puts a key down on the piano, and they're alone. And she was putting his clothes in a suitcase. She was taking out his paper. And then she's sitting there before I do a big telephone call. And I said to Sydney, wouldn't it be better if she was angry at first? Meaning she takes out his paper and slams it shut, takes his clothes and puts it in a suitcase and slams that, and then takes his shaving cream out of the thing and puts it in a can, you know. And then you cut to quiet, far shot. You don't know what's going to happen. She's quiet before she makes that telephone call.
Right.
You know, but Sydney was a wonderful director. Believe me, there was a part of me that I couldn't cry in a scene, and he didn't have to say anything to me. He just held me for a moment, and that was it. You know, I mean, he was fabulous. I adored him. But it just shows you that from that moment, I couldn't control that.
But that's amazing that you... Because again, it wasn't a path that was chosen, but that's the path you chose. Okay, I'm just going to direct my own movies. I mean, that's very bold. That's very, you know. Well,
I also believe in serving the director's vision.
Right.
So it was, you know, if Sydney wanted it that way, I did it the best I could. Because I remember saying to him, "You have me crying in five scenes right near each other. Wouldn't it be better to just take a couple away and don't have me cry?" I didn't want to cry, but I did it because he wanted.
Wanted you to. But after you started directing, I don't think I've asked you this before. Did you find it hard to just act again? Was the director always working, or were you fine to relinquish?
Oh no, it was so easy to act.
Yeah,
because once you write, work on a script that long, and you know everything about the movie, the texture, the language, the lighting, it's all in your head. It was the easiest part, and that's what I told you. I always filmed the other actors first.
Oh, no, I'm in somebody else's movie that you're not directing.
Oh, somebody else's movie.
That you're not directing.
Uh-huh.
Harder to... I get it. I figured. You know,
Well, yeah, like Star is Born. Yeah, like Star is Born. Well, Star is Born... That was tough. That was really tough because I was, in a sense, blackmailed into... hiring the director. I had hired him to write.
Right.
And then before he would do another rewrite, he said, "By the way, I won't do it unless I direct." Now, I had control over that movie. I had final cut with the first artist company. That's what they gave the artists, final cut.
Right.
So, and I had that movie in my head. And I worked on the script a lot. So, and the songs and all that. I said, "Look, you could have all the credit, but you have to allow my vision to be as well, I mean, as yours." It was interesting that I'm like a straight shooter. I tell you what I think. But he was kind of, he would say, I agree with that. And then I'd come on the set and the camera's in a completely other position. I said, "What do you mean?" You know, it's like, that was tough because, let's say, I would say, I was doing my song Evergreen, and I wanted to do, the whole movie was live singing. And so I say, "I have the idea for it, you know, we do it in one shot, and the camera's going to start on a microphone, my hand will come into frame, and then my head can come into frame. And then as the camera moves around, you see another hand on her hand. And it's Kris Kristofferson. And it will see, if that camera goes in 180 degrees, you will see everything you have to see. You will see me. You will see Kristofferson. You will see a two shot. You will be behind my head and see Chris. And then you just come back." It was like the simplest thing. So I could sing the song in one take. I don't like to break up songs and things and scenes even. So you pick a size that was normal, natural. It held the microphone.
Right.
That determined the reality of the piece. You know, I even sang the wrong lyrics. It shows you how live it was. You know what I mean? But now the director comes in and says, "No, I don't like the size. I think it should be." I think he wanted it tighter or looser. I can't remember, but we did this other size that made no sense. It wasn't real. It wasn't, why would you even be closer or why would you be wider? It had no, I knew I got it because in that take, in the first take, Chris pulled away because he was very insecure singing with me. In the second take, perfect, because I said to him before, whatever happens, don't leave me here alone. You have to stay with me, okay? And so here he's pulling away and I'm grabbing him back. You know, all on film, all for real. You know, he did something that I loved and I kissed him in the middle of it. You could never do this if this was lip-synced. And I'm a terrible lip-syncer because I can't be in the moment if I'm trying to do something that was done 3 months before. Do you know what I mean? I don't work that way.
Right.
So it's more fun my way.
I love hearing how you had strong opinion, but also part of it's that it's so subjective, right? Because it's just subjective. He might have thought that frame looked good. You just thought it was better, tighter. Or is that why it's not so much that you want to just have your way and that you want control, but it's so subjective that
it is
people
subjective,
have different
isn't it?
Opinions.
Yeah, I mean, we did it his way as well. You know, he could do whatever he wants. I just wanted, and another thing, see, I would be in the middle of a song and it was in profile, and then it was really good, and he yelled, cut. I go, why did you cut? He says, your head went out of frame. Now, I said, if you have a good operator, he'll follow my head. Two, my head will come back, even if he doesn't follow. You know,
don't
it'll
cut.
Go like that.
Don't cut.
So it was insane to me. That's you so know what funny. I mean? Like, why? Because I saw Christofferson do something. He was in a very poignant scene alone. Hangs up the telephone, and Frank yelled, cut. But the actor was processing what he was doing or what he just felt like. It was so interesting that I saw that he doesn't see the truthful moment. Actors are very interesting. And so he yelled action, but I yelled cut.
That's awesome. You know, you did a record recently with Jamie Foxx, sang on one of the tracks, called Encore, by the way, her new album. You have to get it. It's really terrific.
Jamie's fantastic.
He worked with a director friend of mine. My director friend told me this because he knew I was going to come speak to you. He said, oh, it was funny. I was having a conversation with Jamie Foxx, my director friend said. And it came up that y'all did an album together. And Jamie asked my director friend, have you ever met Barbara? And my friend said, no, I haven't. And Jamie said, she gangsta. And you are. I mean, you inspire so many people. I mean, when you say these stories, they inspired this young Hispanic filmmaker from San Antonio,
sweet.
Texas,
I'm so happy.
To go up into an industry where you felt like you didn't have a voice. And to see you do it really was inspiring. And when you made your first film, Yentl, I mean, my family was already a big fan of yours, but to see my five sisters watching it over and over again for a whole other reason, because they saw the power that you had in making this in this film, it really is life-changing for people.
That's so nice. Thank you. That's lovely.
And you told me the most fascinating thing about that that made me think a lot about why diversity and is so important in Hollywood. You told me that when you shot Yentl, it was actually a very smooth experience that you didn't, no one even questioned you being a director like you had
That's
thought.
Right.
And why was that?
It was because they had a woman prime minister, Margaret Thatcher.
You shot in England.
In England, that's right. And they had a queen. So what was I? You know, a little Pishika first-time director. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean,
a woman in power like that was not.
They were used to it.
They're used to it. But then when you would come back here
to America,
be backlash.
It was tough.
It made me realize, there's a cultural problem.
Yeah.
And the only way that changes is by diverse voices, more women in film.
Yeah.
And yet those are the ones who are held back.
Exactly.
But That's what is needed. Yentl was a triumph. I mean, I love so much about that movie, and we'll go into it. And it was even recognized by Academy, 4 Academy Award nominations, maybe even 5.
5, but who's counting?
Who's counting? I forget those because the one that stands out the most, besides Best Picture, was the lack of Best Director. She didn't get nominated for Best Director. Now,
it wasn't nominated for Best Picture. That was Prince of Tides.
Oh, okay.
That was Prince of Tides.
I got that mixed up.
I cannot tell a lie.
Okay, well, Best Director was overlooked. Okay, possibly
a
snub.
That was the Golden Globes that it was, that it won.
You possibly a snub. We'll see what happens. But it really does mean a lot for women, for minorities, when you get robbed, that's a bad thing because you need that recognition to get your next gig. A man will go and take those 4 nominations and get, 8 movies in the next 8 years. You didn't direct another movie for 8 years. Mm-hmm. Why did you wait so long to make Prince of Tides? Not that it wasn't worth waiting for, but
At the time, I felt okay about it. It was like it made the subject of discrimination against women. It put a spotlight on it. It was like, huh? People thought. But so it didn't, I was pleased to see people holding up signs at the Academy Award. I didn't go that night. So I thought it was interesting. But I must have been more hurt than I thought. Because it's like I didn't want to direct for years.
Right.
Until I found The Prince of Tides. I also have to have a passion for a project.
Right, right.
It's like otherwise...
I mean, you produced a film in that time. I was just wondering why. It just really surprised me you didn't direct for so long after. But again, it's also this lack of material. In fact, you had to write Yentl. You were one of the writers on Yentl. That thing didn't just pop out of the air. So it takes time to create your own projects.
Right,
so that you found... Prince of Tides is remarkable because it's such a different movie than you've even acted in before. What drew you to that project? Because that was really surprising coming from you.
I didn't want to take another 5 years of planning this thing beside the other, the 14 years completely. So I wanted to see how I could do that faster. So that one only took 3.5 years. But it was exciting. I loved making that movie. And I went away on a boat trip after I went to a symposium, which was so interesting because it's like at the moment of commitment, the universe does conspire to assist you, said by Goethe. And as soon as I thought that's what I really want to do, I went to this symposium filled with doctors and therapists. And I was looking for the character of the wounded healer, right? And I found it right there. And these sessions are all taped. Wow. And some of the things that were said, and, so I went on this boat trip with a great friend, Steve Ross, who used to be the head of Warner Brothers. Divine, lovely, kind, sweet man. And it's funny, the room had a desk for writing, looking out at the ocean. And he was going to Greece, where that's the basis of mythology. And the two characters in Prince of Tides were twins. Mm-hmm. And so sort of everything just fell into place. I was able to distill the novel that was 47 or 87 pages, and see that quiet and being in a wonderful company and in a foreign country, I was able to figure out what the movie would be to me. Because somebody said it should be, it's such a big book, it should be a 13 series.
Right. Mini-series. Or something. You got a fantastic performance from Nick Nolte. You're terrific in it too. Is it hard to act in a movie that you're directing?
No. As I said,
I think, check the
no, because there's less people to argue with. You don't have to argue with the producer or the, the director. I come last. The directors, the other actors are first. That's my biggest joy, is to get the best performances out of other actors. And then it's the director's vision, then it's the producer who has to, you know, sort the financial with the aesthetic, the creative. And then the actress, because she just dumps, you know, she steps in at the end. And you can be as simple as you want, you know?
If you haven't seen Prince of Tides, watch it, and you'll be very surprised that she made it. It doesn't seem like a Barbra Streisand movie. It really shows her growth as a director. One of my favorite things about it, too, it's a small thing, but you didn't even put one of your songs in the movie, even though you had one. You put it on the soundtrack, but not in the movie, because
that's right. It would take
away probably from the film showing. And that's your audience that's right. counts on that. They pay money to see your songs and the end credits.
The studio wanted an Academy Award nomination for a new song. I thought, I can't do it. Now, it's interesting. Redford didn't want me to sing at the end of The Way We Were. But there I didn't mind it because I wasn't the director.
Right.
And Sidney loved it.
And it does go with the movie, with the romance of the movie.
But here, directing it and then singing it, and then so I thought, why is this psychiatrist singing?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That's badass. But and the movie is it's a powerhouse movie, and this time the Academy was paying attention. 7 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture. No nomination for Best Director again. That is clearly, I mean, back then it's just confusing. Now looking back historically, of course it's a fucking snub. They want to put you in your place. Used to say that and people would say, oh, she's just, no, it's true.
There were a lot of older people, older directors too, that they're not used to they don't want to see a woman director, I don't think. And then there's the whole notion of, I don't know how many women wanted to see another woman director, because then you get into competition and a bit of jealousy and, you know, because I was telling you earlier, the most vitriolic reviews of Yentl, maybe even Prince of Tides, those I remember. But I don't remember what they said. I just remember being shocked. I remember the first, I was on some sort of special talking about Yentl, and after it was Channel 7. And the woman said, oh, I'm going to give you the first review of Yentl. Stay tuned. By the way, this woman was the girlfriend of another producer that I worked for. And she was upgraded. He saw to it that she went from a cooking show to a TV critic, you know, doing movies now, right? And I'll never forget the sound of her voice. She said, well, you want to know what I think about Yentl? I liked it, but I didn't love it. You know.
Thanks, sister.
The New York Times, I remember that because... Oh, that was about Yentl, yeah. She said, she's wearing designer yarmulkes. And she said, I didn't like the lighting coming in that window on her father. Now, David Watkin is a brilliant cinematographer. The light on him was gorgeous. And every piece of clothing I wore was from books and research from the YIVO Institute and Polish Jews and so forth. And it was the same yarmulke they, you know, Ingmar Bergman had in Fanny, what was it called again? Fanny and Alexander, thank you. But she criticized my why. None of the women at the time, I remember, except I think Pauline Kael, but I forget these reviews, honestly. But I think it was good. I'm not sure. But it was not about what the movie was about, a celebration of women and all they could be. They could, you know, make the tzimis for dinner, and they could have babies, and they could study and be smart. None of them talked about that, what it was the movie was trying to say.
Right.
So go figure.
But you caused a lot of change. I know that's not why you did it, but so many more women now are in film because of you. In fact, the only woman to ever win for a Best Director was Catherine Bigelow, and it just so happened
Yes.
You were the one handing her the award at this
I
ceremony.
Thought that because I knew she was going to win. And I thought, I remember just ad-libbing, it's about time or something like that. It was like, of course she should win.
How did that feel? I mean, you must have known that it's because of you
that became a path for people.
Really, it did. It really changed people's thinking.
Well,
it made me think Mexican get into Hollywood. That's what I think.
But how many years later was that from Yentl? I forgot.
What?
You know, when she won the Academy
Award. Well, that was 2007 or 2008, 2007.
And Yentl was 1983. You know,
I know my Barbara.
It took a long time. And look, not enough women are directing now.
Enough?
Not enough.
Not enough. Oh, no, no, not at all. No, it's never enough, but it's certainly more than it was because of, you mean,
well,
really
I love when I see a woman's name on a film and then I always pray that it's good.
Yeah.
You know? Well, I mean, I want it to be good. I want to support that.
I'm just curious, when you're directing and acting at the same time, like you're in a scene with Nick Nolte, do you just go ahead and get lost in the scene as an actor, or is the director always working and are you using that as an opportunity?
The director is always working. And by the way, it's tough for the other actor sometime because right. I remember doing a scene with Mandy Patinkin. Patinkin. Thought Potemkin, I don't know. Patinkin. And, you know, we're walking down a street and I have to look at him. What, do you like this girl? I mean, she has a... Whatever the lines were, but and then you stop the scene, and then I go, you know, on that line, because I have no coverage. Maybe try it another way, or right. Play with it, or something. And he was like shocked. He was like, but you know, oh, he said to me, I remember him saying to me, "You're looking at me," and I said, "Well, I'm the character looking at you," because you know I was talking about your girlfriend in there. So it can be confusing.
Right.
I mean, it's tough, you know? I mean, it's not necessarily easy for the other actor.
Right, no. You see them, they probably look at you and say, okay, she's reacting, but she's also thinking, I could put a 50 millimeter on this and
that's right.
Get it again.
Exactly.
I really love that quote that you said. You know, how long do you hold that note? Because I want to. What advice would you give to those? Because you seem fearless, and I know you'll laugh at that, but...
What advice
would you give to those who have fear of putting themselves out there?
But I do it anyway.
You do it anyway.
Put it that way.
What advice would you give to those who have fear of criticism, that fear of not knowing, that fear of following their inner voice, fear of failure, but also fear of success? Because if you're successful, you'll get criticized even more like you do, like you've been saying. That fear in general, what would you tell people? Because you're so adept at creativity.
But I think that fear is like an engine to create. Do you know what I mean?
That's just how you see it. That's a great thing right there. You're using it as an engine and not a wall. So yeah, how do you feed off of that fear?
Don't mention a wall to me. I don't want any wall. I can't stand that word anymore.
Do you consider yourself an actress, a singer, or a director first? I mean, because you're so many things. What would you consider yourself first or that you enjoy the most?
I think probably actress only because that's what I wanted to be first. Mm-hmm. And then I sang because I couldn't get a job as an actress. And then I directed because I couldn't be heard.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
The stories you wanted to tell weren't being told or being given to you.
Or, you know, I couldn't control the outcome. I had no power. So... No, I like being responsible for my work, you know, taking the blame and the reward.
You said something interesting backstage. Now, today, if you had to choose between an acting gig and a directing gig, you would choose directing. You'd rather direct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, now I just really want to direct. Acting is too much trouble. You have to put on makeup. You have to have your hair done.
I think there's some microphones. If people want to ask a question, you can line up behind a mic. Somebody said there was microphones. Is there microphones? Okay, who's first on the questions there? Back there with a microphone.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
How were you able to deal with being a mom and continue to go forward with your career and deal with that, you know, the guilt of being a mom, being away from your child, but still persevering as a singer? Because for me, if I don't do that, I won't be who I am.
You know, you do the best you can. I mean, right? When you come home, do you bathe your child? Do you read stories? Do you sing with him or her? You know, it's the connection. It's that connection. I always believed in being very honest with my son. And I'm very, very proud of him today. I mean, he's a great singer, by the way, my son. Just made an album produced by Quincy Jones. That's about to come out soon. So you do the best you can, you know? It's like we blame our mothers for this and that. And then you outgrow that and you realize life is tough. It's not easy. And as I said, do the best you can.
Thank you. Next question.
Hi, Barbara. Hi, Barbara. Hi. This is probably the biggest thrill of my life. I have loved you since I was 12 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I have all your everything, you know, the works. I want to ask you, what goes into when you make albums, and I have all of them, what goes into selecting the songs? Because you have selected some of the most gorgeous songs in the world.
It was always about, well, it had to be a great lyric, something that I could act, because when I started to sing, because I couldn't get a job as an actress, I looked for songs that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. So the character could go someplace. Like a song like If I Loved You, probably, you know, is a song about, well, you know, she loves him, but she can't show it. So, you know, if, you know, defensive. And then by the end of the song, she's almost shy because she maybe admitted too much. But that's all because If I Love You. I mean, it's really interesting to pick songs, you know, from a lyric point of view, but it also has this magnificent melody to sing.
I know there are other people. The Bergmans have such, you've had been so close with them.
Yeah.
Have they helped you select a lot of the songs?
No.
Or you've done all the selecting on your own?
No, except for their songs. I've sung 60 of their songs. So they write, you know, they understand drama. And the score of Yentl was pretty fantastic, I must say. And it was so much fun to do over the years with them. So. Yeah, they're great. Good luck. My pleasure.
Thank you.
My pleasure. You're welcome.
It was funny. When I went to your concert, took my mom to see your concert.
In Texas.
In Texas. You never played Texas. So
never,
we were there,
right?
And it was wonderful. But it was so funny. At the end, you asked me, because you talk between your songs. And it's mm-hmm. fascinating. It's like this, but she right. sings in between. So you get to hear all these great stories. And you asked me a funny question at the end. You said, do you think I talk too much in between songs? Mm-hmm. I thought, hasn't that been your act since the 60s? I mean, you still ask people for advice. You still have sure. that unsure of
yeah,
yourself
I
in some ways.
I like to ask people because it kind of strengthens my own opinion.
Right. And but even after that much time, though.
Oh, yeah.
Because I love it. I mean, you kind of almost don't need the music because you're like, hey, I love just hearing her stories. I loved it. But
oh,
it was
good.
Funny that you
good,
would
good,
still,
good.
I thought it was very charming
oh, no.
that you would
I don't
still
think
ask
you ever,
people.
You know, that's just what, that just would be arrogant. That means I'm a little girl.
I thought it was
still full of
really
wonder as adorable. Well as a mature woman. You know what I mean? It's like, that's I think, the core of creativity. It's that child within. So
you have
the child
amazing.
Still is. Did you
keeping
like that?
Keeping that alive, I think, is the key to your success. Because to be that much of a multi-hyphenate means, you know, there's a book called The One Thing. You should just pick one thing and do one thing.
Oh, really?
That doesn't apply to you, right? But it does in a way.
No, because
you live a creative life. You use creativity in everything you do. And that makes everything available to you. It's why you can jump from job to job, basically, and do really well at it, because they're all tied by creativity. And you're one of the most creative, actively creative people that I've ever met. So I'm very proud.
Well, directing is like, you know, because I love to decorate and design things. So directing is such a great thing to do because you get to do all those things. I love, you know, costume design, production design. How is a set going to function? You know, how you know, for Amy, I wanted her to be the feminine aspect of the film in Yentl. And so I say, oh, she has this gorgeous red hair. So when she makes her first entrance, let's put a sconce, told Roy Walker, you know, on the wall right there to justify this beautiful glow, her backlight. You know, that's the fun of it. It's not just.
But you know that you are into design and building as well as many of your other many talents, and in a way, because of the way you are able to envision and manifest and design and build, you've designed your career and your life. You've built all of this yourself. So when I asked at the beginning, how are you able to do this? That makes sense that you're able to build, design, and see what is needed. And then if it's not happening, you fill that void yourself.
Let's take a
question.
I try.
Hi. I'm a singer also, and I really believe you made me a singer since I was a little girl. I just love you so much. But anyway, I was just wondering if when you were a young girl, if you had a barber, somebody like an idol, like that you would just like thought.
Who did you look up to? Who was sort of like a mentor?
It was Johnny Mathis. Yeah, I just thought he was so beautiful with those dark eyes. I'll never forget seeing him on the Ed Sullivan Show when we first got a TV, you know, and he had this gorgeous instrument and he was so soulful. And he seemed like he was in pain a bit. I'm always drawn to pain for some reason. But yeah, that was him.
One last question there and then we'll wrap it up.
Hi, so I'm
curious. Oh, it's good to have a man speak. That's great, no.
I'm glad I sound like one. I'm glad I sound like one. But I'm not offended if I don't sound like one. So Barbara, I'm curious to know, you say that you wanted to be a classical actress or classical actor studying and playing Ibsen and Chekhov and Shakespearean roles. One of your dream roles was to be Juliet, of course, which I think you should totally still do.
You know what? Sarah Bernhardt played her at 74. But on the stage.
I will buy that ticket.
Not a close-up.
I'm curious to know if you still have those desires or wishes or miss those opportunities as you are now, or if the career that you've established has compensated for that in any way?
No, I still think I could see the opening. I couldn't get the writer I wanted to do a piece about Sarah Bernhardt because it was really basically to play those great roles. You know, she played Hamlet, she played L'Aiglon, the young Napoleon. In a sense, that's Yentl. You know what I mean? She played those men's roles as well as Camille and all those kind of great roles. So I think about it, but it's so hard to get these things done today. You know? I mean, you have to. Because part of me says, I'm lazy. I'm also lazy. I like to do nothing. I like to garden. That's what I was doing the last few days before I came here. You know, placing plants, redesigning something in all white.
Always building, always designing,
yeah.
Always creating.
Yeah. And so. Be left alone because it's hard to be in the limelight. I don't really like stardom. You have to understand that. I really don't like it and what comes with it. And I don't like all that. Some people do. Some people really like that. I'm not one of them. So I don't know what I'll do next.
Well, you show no signs of stopping ever. We just saw her show. It was so funny. My parents, I asked, do you mind if my mom meets you backstage? She goes, I hope I have a voice left after the show. Okay, well, she'll do all the talking. Don't worry. We went to the show, and she just gave a magnificent concert. We go in the back. I figured she would just shake my mom's hand. Oh, no. She invites us into the dressing room. She's got curtains up, a film crew. She sat and interviewed my parents for 45 minutes after her show.
Because I can't believe somebody has 10 children.
And you filmed it. It was like she had her own talk show back there.
I was fascinated.
Barbara After Hours. It was amazing.
Yeah,
it was like she could be broadcasting that show.
It was so sweet.
I was so amazed. You just don't show any signs of stopping. Icon, legend, inspiration, one of the most prolific and accomplished talents. She Gangsta Barbara Streisand.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, visit TribecaFilm.com.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at VisitCalifornia.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.